All right, everyone, let's do this. Welcome to this week's episode of our podcast. It's called Is Breakfast Included? Thanks for stopping by. On the show this week, I sit down with my good friend and co-worker of 14 years, Gary Oldno. Now, Gary is our, in layman's terms, he's our video guy, but he is much more than that. I knew he was much more than that. I just had to dig a little deep. He came on, we sat here on a day off, and he gave me the scoop, a little bit about his background, how he got into photography, how he got into the whole video thing. And he's definitely one of the most interesting people I know. I've known this for a long time. So to get Gary to sit down and talk to me about it was a really treat. And it's going to be a treat for you guys. I hope you enjoy it. Let's check it out.
Yes.
Yeah, so, tell everyone who you are.
Oh, okay. Well, who I was. I was actually born with a different name.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So this is my real name, Gary Oldno. But,
okay.
You know, for the first 30 years of my life, I was called Gary Hitch.
Hitch. And why Hitch?
Well, it's a good story. So I was abandoned at birth and brought up by horses. And then the horses abandoned me. Right.
That's got to be something for self-esteem.
Yeah, and my whole life is loosely based on a true story.
Really?
Yeah. So, I was actually adopted by the Hitch family. And then when I was in my 30s, I found my real birth certificate and went and contacted, my biological relatives. And it turns out that well-balanced, socially adjusted people don't leave their kids with strangers. How I ended up in showbiz.
Where all the most well-balanced people end up, right? That's where we all end up.
Yeah. No, I actually got in showbiz completely by accident. At the time, the first serious job I had after I left college was performing autopsies in the mortuary. And I got to see a lot of things. A lot of things that remain with me for the rest of my life.
Yeah.
But it was a really fascinating job.
Yeah.
The scientific side of it was incredible, but the sociological side of it, dealing with people in, intense trauma and panic and distress.
Yeah.
And then the whole sort of in England, we've got a lot of different cultures, and there was this marked disparity between the different cultures in dealing with bereavement. So it was really a fascinating thing to do. And I quit the moment that I went to the neighboring hospital when I was fully qualified and met one of my contemporaries. And he was like Lurch out of the Addams Family. And he was like, "Hello, Gary. I've been looking forward to meeting you." And his assistant actually had a hunchback. And I'm like, "I ain't doing this for the rest of my life." just quit pretty much there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But the big thing, one of the undertakers was going blind and he sold me all of his photographic equipment. And suddenly I had this completely new path in my life in dealing with imagery. Because up until that point, I didn't meet a middle-class person until I left school. My background was working class, and we didn't have things like real cameras. We had these little holiday snaps things.
The instincts.
And then suddenly I had this gadget that would do photos like you see in the music press.
Yeah.
And stuff. And I just went with it. And then I picked up, I got some slide projectors. And in the projector shop, they had an effects projector, like a 60s light show kind of thing. And I ended up with a couple of those in a rucksack. And I'd go to people's parties and just turn the lights up, put projectors on, and do these little light shows at people's parties. And then somebody phoned me up and they said, we've heard you got this incredible 60s psychedelic light show and we want you to come and work in our film, our club. And I said, no. And they said, yeah, you have. And we want you to come and work in our club. So I basically just made one up and went and worked in this nightclub doing a 60s psychedelic light show. And within a couple of weeks, I was waiting for a band.
So when they asked you, when they said, we've heard you had this really cool psychedelic projector, we want you to come, when you told them no, like you were just telling them, no, I don't want to?
No, I haven't got it. Oh. I actually haven't got one.
Okay.
But like I said, I just made one up. And within a couple of months, I was working for The Dam.
Oh, okay.
With Craig Duffy.
Yeah. People. Wow, the late Craig Duffy. Yeah, rest in peace.
And then before I know it, I was off on tour with Gay Bikers on Acid. And they really, well, apart from the gay bit, they really lived up to the name. And we had a pretty, pretty far out time, I must say.
All right. So yeah. You basically, you learned on the job. You kind of faked it. And then
and pretty soon after that, I became the first person in the UK to project on buildings. Specifically, this French company just opened up an office. And I got introduced to them, and nobody knew how it really works. I had to invent all my own techniques to get, because we're using giant slides, I had to make them all in the dark room.
Yeah.
So I had to come up with this method for getting these slides to perfectly fit the buildings. And the French hadn't really figured it out, but I got this camera that I bought off the Undertaker, calibrated it. So that I could, because the really hard thing about projecting on buildings is if you've got this skyscraper that's on the other side of the river, there's no way you can measure those kind of distances and use maths to do it. So I calibrated the camera, and I knew that if I took a photo with this, I could use this lens with this projector, make the slide this shape, and it would perfectly fit the building.
Yeah.
And that's that, really. I invented this technique for projection mapping.
Right. Like what kind of images were you projecting? Yeah, were you projecting back then?
Well, you know, some of it was advertising, some of it was political protests and things like that. And some of it was just fun. We had these projectors, and we'd jump in the back of the van and just drive around London projecting on buildings all night. Whatever we wanted. So yeah. It was great fun.
So, working as with doing autopsies and so forth, and how much of your past life do you pull into whatever you're doing?
Life's an ongoing process.
Yeah,
you know.
Do you ever find yourself doing something and go, "Well,
that's certainly I can look. I can find myself in a difficult situation and just think, oh, you think that's difficult? You should try doing autopsies." But quite a lot of it, certainly in the show business, I've just learned to be really stable and relaxed. And the more dangerous a situation is, the more relaxed I am generally. Like I was working in November in Miami in this giant inflatable planetarium, and it got hit by a water tornado, a water spout while we were in it. And everybody's panicking. I was just like, okay, guys, we're just going to open all the doors. Walk away.
Yeah.
And I just got all the guys out and we just walked away.
The next day,
everything was absolutely ripped to bits and under like 4 feet of water.
So it doesn't matter if you panic, it's going to happen anyway.
It's just going to make things worse if you panic.
Yeah.
That's the thing I learned very, very quickly. In show, is it doesn't help at all.
Yeah.
So
there, I've known you 14 years.
Yeah, something like that.
Something like that. There are so many different versions of Gary Holdno that I've gotten to know. And what I told you the other day, I was like, man, you're one of the most interesting people I know.
I'll tell you why that is, actually. I never really make this known about myself, but I've actually got quite bad amnesia.
Okay.
And I work from lists and things. I quite a nasty bang on the head about 20 years ago. I couldn't remember a damn thing for nearly 10 months.
Yeah.
I could remember everything up to the bang and then nothing afterwards. So I couldn't really make new memories. And everybody thought it was hilarious. They were all like borrowing money off me and not giving it back to me and stuff. But I really had to get my act together to be able to function.
Mm-hmm.
And ever since then, you know, I do remember things like turning up here, but I did go to the wrong room. And I knocked on Gilly's door just now.
Yeah.
I just have to organize my life and around it.
Yeah.
And I do remember things, but I don't tend to rely on my memory because sometimes it does let me down.
So you make a list of everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Does that help on your day? Is it a daily thing?
Or
is it a daily list is what I'm saying?
Yeah, well, I've got, they're all on the phone now, but there's I've got about 40 or 50 different lists and, you know, things I need to put in my suitcase and things I need to do at work and people I need to talk to. And, you know, unless I just write it all down now, and at least that way, it works.
Yeah, I really have a bad habit of remembering things. I make lists, but then I forget to look at the list. Or, like you said, it's on my phone, I can't find it, and then I'm here with 50 t-shirts because I forgot that I left t-shirts in my, you know, or, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But so, certainly, you know, most of my friends are like, oh, I can't remember anything. I'm like, yeah, but if you stop smoking,
right,
it all comes back.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's that exaggeration like, oh, I can't remember anything, but you really can't remember anything.
Yeah, yeah. And it's strange because, you know, if I broke my leg, everybody go, that must be really terrible and difficult for you. Losing memory. This looks hilarious.
Yeah.
But I'm just so used to it now.
Yeah.
I don't really notice it.
Yeah.
But maybe that's why there's all these different Garys, because none of them knows what's going on.
It could be. It could be. You know, when Gary, I met you at, was it the big hangar there where rehearsals, is it
LA Free?
Something. We were doing we were starting the All You Need Is Now tour. And then I remember I hadn't met you before that. And all I remember is you coming in on your scooter with a samurai sword on your back.
Right.
And I thought, who is this guy? And then you came up to me and you said, where do you want this camera? And I'm like, where do you want to put it? I'm not the camera guy, you know?
But I didn't want to intrude on Roger's personal space in that sense. You know, wherever you put him, it's always the wrong place.
Yeah, especially since I don't look after Roger.
Yeah. But it was odd that, because, I mean, at that point, I'd worked for the band at least 10 years.
Yeah.
And nobody knew who I was.
Yeah.
Because you guys were all new, but you all knew each other.
Yeah, because we had done a short run. We were all new, but we were all getting to know each other.
Yeah.
And then after I got you, I think it was a few weeks we were in, and we were talking, and then I was like, oh, you've been with the band forever. You and Davey.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
How did you get involved with these guys?
I just worked as a tech for a little company of these two guys, and I used to know this guy who was a lawyer, and he said, guess what kind of law I do? My clients say, I trusted that person with my life, and they betrayed me, you know, I thought I could trust them with anything, and they were cheating on me behind my back. And I said, you're a divorce lawyer? He said, no, I do business partnership. and these guys were in a business partnership. And sure enough, they got divorced during this Duran tour. And it was like a proper breakup. And they both went their separate ways. And I inherited Duran.
Okay.
And been with them ever since, 26 years now.
And you're obviously not, you're obviously well-liked. I know, because I work with you and I like you. I always get a good feeling when I see you on the email list. But they obviously think a lot of you to keep you around for this long, you know?
Well, you know, we're English first and foremost, and we're not allowed to take compliments in any way, shape, or form.
I know. And,
but as you know yourself, you know, your the technical side of your job is maybe 10% of your responsibility.
Yeah.
And the most important bit is trust. You know, people need to know that they're not going to get in trouble when they ask you to do something.
Yes.
You know, because they trust you implicitly and they know you're reliable.
Yeah.
So I guess that's a big part of my relationship too. The real difference my job's unique in the touring party because this means that Vince can't offend people with the lights, but the images have meaning.
Yeah.
And you can combine relationships with images and create completely different meanings to the individual images.
Yeah.
And if you're aware of that and you're aware of the psychic space that both the band and the audience can inhabit, then you can build an emotional environment that the concert takes place within that wouldn't exist without that physical, that visible dimension.
Yeah.
You see, so it's quite a big responsibility. And it, for me, it's a real stretch because, you know, I've got a medical background and suddenly I'm dealing it, you know, with like the psychological meaning of dreams and certainly with the fans' devotion. There's a big crossover between religious devotion and the relationship people have with music.
Yeah.
But interestingly enough, they found out recently by doing MRI scans of people while they listen to music, and they found out that the part of the brain that recognizes patterns and anticipates reward and has and listens and likes to music's all the same space. And it's also where the brain perceives deep personal emotion. So when you listen to music from your favorite band, it automatically triggers deep personal emotions just by accident, pretty much.
Yeah.
But that's why music is such an important thing in people's lives. And certainly when you get these big legacy bands like Duran, it's the soundtrack to an entire life across two or three generations.
Yeah.
You know, we're getting people coming to the shows whose mothers were fans when they were 14.
Yeah.
You know, they took down all the posters of the Horses and they put up the poster of John Taylor. And then their children are coming. And they, of course, they know all the words.
Yeah.
Because it's been an intrinsic part of their emotional life.
Yeah.
So, and then that's quite a big responsibility when you're asked to augment the music, because you know music on its own is very, very different to a pop video,
for example,
and again concerts are radically different to pop videos. You can show the pop videos on stage, but they're usually too fast and too flashy, and very often they compete with the band for attention, and so that I have to perform a balancing act between stepping back, coming up front. It's almost like sax play, you know.
Yeah.
You come up, do a little solo every now and then.
You go back.
Then you go back. And certainly before you started working for Duran, it was my show visually. And I worked within those parameters and made it, you know, occasionally it'd be the set, occasionally it'd just be part of the background, and then occasionally we'd have a special made video that would come in front. And it used to make people cry.
Wow.
You know,
yeah.
I did this thing for Save a Prayer once, and we've got these decaying Victorian graveyards in England, and I went down and shot it all in infrared, and it's just overgrown tombstones of weeping angels, you know, desperately bereaved and in love forever. And to put that behind this song that's basically about a one-night stand triggered all these deep emotions within the fans that just got them weeping.
Yeah.
And it was quite a thing, but obviously you can only do that for the one tour.
Yeah.
And it's great now because I'm more like a curator. In many ways, my original role of playing the content in time, because it was all tape machines and what have you back then, it's been superseded by a computer, but now I get to program the computer that's got my job. So it's worked out all well. Yeah.
There's always still that. You were saying earlier, like, music is scientific. There's a scientific reaction to music, and what you were saying about they did MRIs. I don't know if you saw the documentary about Glenn Campbell, who was far into his dementia already, far into his Alzheimer, and he was still touring. And his wife said, because that's what he remembers. The minute he walks on stage, he remembers the music. He remembers the lyrics, and he was putting on amazing shows, great shows for someone that deep into dementia. And
having lost my memory, I know quite a lot about memory, actually, and there's lots of different kinds. Your smell memory is one of the strongest. And you know, you can get a whiff of something, and it will take you back 40 years, put you in a room, you know, and you wouldn't get that any other way. And when I was learning to cope with memory loss, I'd sit there and think, what was I doing 2 days ago? I haven't got a clue. And I could think, well, you know, what was my mate Dave doing 2 days ago? And was I with him at the time? And I could kind of go around and maybe find my way back to a memory that way. And when it all stopped, it was like a camera coming into focus, because the memories were actually all been there. I just couldn't find them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then suddenly I found this way back in, and I was like, oh, that happened.
Yeah. That doesn't happen to me. Usually if there's a whiff around me, it takes you back to what I have for lunch.
So what else can I tell you? Yeah, so I also worked in the right at the center of house music when it broke.
Uh-huh.
And there were only like three people doing light shows in the whole UK. But this club started in a venue called Heaven, and they wanted a hippie vibe. So they got me doing the lights. And then there was another club at a venue called The Fridge that was actually an old cinema. And they weren't allowed to serve drinks unless they showed films. So they had to have projections in order to run the nightclub.
Uh-huh.
And when rave became commodified, they looked at it and thought, well, what is it? It's just strobes, smoke, DJs, and visuals. And it's pretty much off of the back of that, and the fact that you can only watch a DJ putting his hands in the air for so long before you need something else to look at.
Yeah.
And visuals suddenly just came up and took over.
To where it's just the soundtrack to the visuals, pretty much.
Well, in it's sometimes.
Yeah.
It depends, you know. It's a bit like anybody can make music, but not many people can make music that other people want to listen to.
Yeah. True.
And it's the same with visuals. There's a lot of noise out there, you know. But occasionally you see it done really, really well. And when it is done well, it's very, very effective.
When you when you're off, do you ever go to shows? No.
I haven't had a TV for 25 years.
So you just...
Yeah, just keep away from it completely. Yeah. And, you know, when I'm not working, for the last 4 years, I've lived on a boat on the river.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Well, it's great. Yeah. I'd been thinking about it for a while, and then when the pandemic hit...
Mm-hmm.
I did all the pandemic training when I was working in the mortuary. So I knew exactly what was supposed to happen. And I knew that society would either be overwhelmed by the virus or it would have to shut down to protect itself. So I went down to the bank. And they hadn't realized this. And I just borrowed as much money as they gave me, knowing that I won't work again for 2 years.
Yeah.
And I went out and bought a boat. And it's one of the best decisions I ever made. I get up in the morning. Well, late at night, you know, if it's windy, I'll stick my head out the boat and there'll be otters swimming past.
Oh, man.
And then in the morning, you know, there's all the fish hear me get out of bed and they come to the back of the boat and wait for me to feed them. then we get the baby ducks.
Yeah.
And I got a job as a lock keeper during the pandemic.
Yeah.
And just worked on the river. And human beings lived for 100,000 years exclusively on estuaries and rivers, because that's where the most available food source was. They get the salmon runs, and in 6 weeks they get enough food to last them a year. And humans just live around water for hundreds of thousands of years, and we're designed to be around water. And when we are, we get away from the modern rhythm, and we get back into the natural rhythms, you know, like the life cycles of the animals and the weather and the seasons and all of this. And the river's got its own pace, you know, and if you will kind of let yourself get into that pace, everything just becomes so easy. You haven't got to care the world, man. That's fantastic. And they pay me to do it.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, I remember the pictures you
to do.
Yeah. The pictures you sent me during the pandemic, I remember thinking to myself, wow, Gary looks younger. You know?
Yeah, I'm not all careworn like I was.
Right. One thing that I really like about you is you have a very a fascination with the Asian lifestyle, the Asian, you know.
Oh, well, that's another story entirely. Mm-hmm. I used to work for David Bowie, and I didn't realize this, but one of the journalists had recognized me when they went to interview, and they told him that I was a friend. You know, let's wind this loop back a little bit. Before he was a musician, he wanted to become a Buddhist monk. And he actually had a lot of teaching off this Tibetan Lama.
Uh-huh.
And so have I, funnily enough. I've got a very, very long background with tantric Buddhism.
Yeah.
And Yeah, so this journalist told him that I was a friend of his meditation teacher. And he came running up to me afterwards and he said, oh, if there's one thing I really, really wanted to do in my life, it'd be to go to Tibet with my teacher, which is what I actually did. I went to Tibet with his meditation teacher back to his old monastery up there, like 500 miles from the nearest town up in the Himalayas. And and I thought, how on earth did he know? Because, I don't tell anybody about this.
But the journalist told
him. Well, it took me years to figure out, actually, but the journalist told him. And I was like, oh, David Bowie wishes he'd done something I did. I'm like, that's pretty cool. But, we've all got lovely little stories like that. And we've like Ozzy talking about Stevie Wonder playing his favorite song for him.
Yeah.
That was... just can't believe it when things like that happen.
I know, right? I have stories. Sometimes you like to keep those to yourself. We tell each other
because we're
out here in this circus that we work in, but it's hard to tell just I hate to use the word average person, but just an everyday person.
Well, it is because
your
like
story, because they don't.
It looks like you're bigging yourself up.
And
usually that's the last thing on your mind.
If I'm telling somebody something, I usually start it out like, this is going to sound really douchey, but.
Yeah,
but it's something you want to share with them, But I tend to not try and share those stories because.
Well, you can edit this one out.
That's fine. No. That's no. I'm just saying, like, I tend to not tell because you do. It sounds like you're bringing yourself up. And you're like, look at me. I'm living the lifestyle, but really, we're not living any kind of lifestyle. We do a job just like everyone else.
Well, I think you're making a mistake if you think you're in the band.
Yeah.
You're very, very, very much not in the band.
100%. 100%.
You know, you're here to do something that's really, really important.
Yeah.
But you are replaceable.
Everyone is. You know? Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm very committed to my job. It's a big responsibility, and I recognize that.
Yeah.
And I do all the hard work months before the tour. I'm sat in the dark just thinking, if I take this idea here and I put it there and then we... so everything's ready before you even get asked the question and you do this.
I do remember once one instance in rehearsals before this last tour we did, and you had all these really cool visuals, and there was one as it was going and it turned our singer into a zombie. And then after the song, he looked over and goes, whoever did that to my face, don't ever do it again.
That's right. And funnily enough, it never, ever happened again.
So I understand you create it and then you test it in rehearsal.
Well, that was completely accidental.
Yeah.
As it happened, we just happened to have the camera on.
Yeah.
You know, it just happened to be pointing that way. It wasn't intentional at all. But that's the thing, it's this band.
Yeah.
Certainly in the UK, they're like Marmite. Some people love them. Some people are just waiting for an excuse to have a go.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what they're looking for.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you just can't do that.
But this is also a very beloved band. And here, in the US, it's the same thing. They either love them or they hate them.
Mm.
But
they love them here.
Yeah.
They really do.
We're here a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's a strange thing, like you do a show in Italy, there'll be 18,000 people. Then you go 100 miles to Germany and there'll be like 2,000.
Yeah.
And none of it makes sense.
No. And then you go to South America and you could stay there for a year and play every night.
Yeah, yeah.
And be thousands of people every night.
Yeah. Yeah, so apart from that, I work in the world's biggest mobile planetarium. And again, planetariums, they were very much stuck in the Carl Sagan, come with me on a journey from the mysteries of the universe and see a star being born in a galaxy. And people, this client of mine manufactured these inflatable planetariums and just wanted to take it up a level. So I had to teach myself all the ins and outs of spherical projection. And at the time, somebody just invented one of the first computerized planetarium servers, and we got a hold of that and started using it to tell very, very different stories.
Yeah.
And just make people go wow, basically, because immersive visuals are very, very different to the TV. We're all used to TVs and we know when you can watch the adverts and not see them.
Exactly.
Because your mind's able to recognize it, just completely block it out. But with an immersive, like the Dome with a U2, it just completely overwhelms people. They've never seen anything like it. And it takes them back to being as innocent as a child.
Mm-hmm.
And when you've got them in that situation, you really can use the emotional power of and meaning of imagery to actually draw things from the very depths of people's consciousness and make them experience awe and wonder and stuff like that. And we did this big show in Vancouver, 2010 Winter Olympics for the Aboriginal Canadians, they call them up there, the big Native Americans.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, there's no border in their culture. It's all just one big country. And we did this massive show. And it was just overwhelming people. All the politicians were crying on the way out of this. And it was just because we'd done it properly. We really did just pace the whole thing and use the power of the environment and the meaning of the images to just leave people completely in awe and wonder.
Yeah.
And that was great. And at the end of it, I interviewed one of the chiefs on camera and I said, so what do you think of it? And I thought he was just going to say, oh, it's really good. And he said, I watched that show 54 times and I could see my ancestors up in the sky looking down on me. And even now, 54 times later, it still touches me to the very center of my being. And I'm like, I thought he was just going to say you liked it.
Yeah. A simple I liked it would have supposed. Well, you know, I can relate because I was very fortunate to do the U2 sphere. And every night I saw something different. Every night I was amazed. Even for just a split second, I'd walk out from under the stage and just look. I had certainly favorite parts of the show, but I'd walk out and they would hit me different every time. And I ran into a coworker at the airport yesterday and I told him, I was like, you know, it took a couple of weeks, but after a couple of weeks, I realized how special what we did was, you know? So.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that sphere is 10 years ahead of its time.
Yeah.
It's a bit of a white elephant in the terms of how overpowering the technology is behind it to do something that big.
Yeah. When I first walked in there, I was talking to one of the guys and he said, this is what he said to me. He said, I said, this is amazing, you know? And he said, it's funny because he said that exact same thing. The sphere, the technology is 10 years ahead of its time, but within the technology, it's 10 years behind, you know?
Yeah.
And it just, it made me think, I was like, you know, like that's crazy.
And it's
think
very
that.
Difficult.
Yeah.
Know? It's like that screen is about 18, 20 times bigger than any screen in the world, which means it's 20 times, takes 20 times longer to do anything.
Yeah.
Yeah. And cost 20 times more.
Which is always the line factor, the cost.
Yeah. So I remember what it was. I forgot. Okay. So I did a degree in digital video, funnily enough. And I mean, it was very interesting, to be honest. But I specialized in the history of projection and the meaning behind it and why people do it. And projection is really interesting because, you know, like they invented the gramophone around about the same time as the cine camera.
Yeah.
You know, and they were hand crank little cine cameras. But like, because of the limits of the projectors themselves, they could only ever use them in dark rooms. So it was like, if you wanted to listen to a record, you'd have to go to a concert hall and you'd all sit there and listen to it. It was very, very sort of similar thing. But certainly in terms of the cinema, there's like a psychology of the hidden watcher involved in the cinema, and that nobody knows you're watching it because you're in the dark. And the film's up there on the screen, and there's this very, very unique relationship between the watcher and the watched. Whereas in concerts, we get away from the cinema and we go more to a spectacle where the band are up there and we're down here, but we're in an open environment and everybody can sing along.
Yeah.
You know, so, and it's a very, very different experience again. But then, certainly going back to the history, cinemas were, and projection was really, really formal until the 60s. And then suddenly it just exploded and it suddenly broke out the cinema. And if you see films like Head by the Monkees, they got this big psychedelic freak-out party scene.
Yeah.
And they're projecting on people's hair. They're projecting on smoke. There's people swinging projectors with their hands as they're dancing, and the projectors just going all around the room. And it completely broke out. and completely changed the dynamic of performance in that the audience became part of the performance. And that's pretty much what a festival is now.
Yeah.
You know, you go to a festival and the show's not just on the stage. Everybody's in the show. Yeah. And they've all got a walk on part in it.
Yeah.
And certainly for me, that was, that was the crossover between, sort of orthodox projection and immersive projection, because in domes particularly, but as you'll see in the future, you'll start getting wraparound projections in hotel rooms. So you won't be watching the TV. You push a button and you'll be in a forest.
Yeah.
Because it's so easy to do.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it'll start to become a feature because the technology is getting so cheap.
Yeah. And there's a place in here in San Francisco, I believe we stayed. You go into your room and it's very dimly lit, but there's projections everywhere. Mm. You know?
Oh, well, there you go. There,
yeah. It? So, I mean, it does have a TV, but you're like, wow, this is pretty cool. You don't even want to turn on the main light, you know, because it's so cool.
Yeah. And I was lucky because I don't know why. I can't remember, funny enough. But, but I just decided to open a VJ store in London about 20 years ago. And it turned out it was the only one ever. And I sold the content,
yeah,
the software, the computers, the mixers, the TVs, the screens, and sort of developed a London VJ scene around it.
Okay.
And through that, I got to know all of the people who were inventing all of the computer programs that were like the precursors of all the stuff that we use on stage now.
Yeah.
And it's quite amazing to see the ride that these things have gone out on, because like some of the big media servers started out as copying musical programs, and some of them copied like slideshow formats and timelines and things, and others just went off in completely different directions. And then they've all had to learn to do everything that everything else could do, but it tends to get stuck on the end instead of being in the middle.
Yeah.
So you get these weird disparities between some of them, like the planetarium one I use in the domes. Does domes fantastic, absolutely useless on buildings. Just can't get its head around it all because it's not spherical. And again, you get these things here, like now the software I use on this show, specifically just because it's the best one for the job.
Yeah.
Where a lot of the time they'll turn up with some box that costs 20 times as much, but it's because they own it.
Yeah. Yeah.
They've right. Got to get it out.
They've got to make their money back. Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. I don't know. How do you want to wrap this up?
Yeah, man. I appreciate your time. I appreciate you doing this. I know we tried to do this back a year ago and you got the COVIDs, couldn't come to my room. But I have one more question for you. Our podcast,
I know what it is, because we eat a lot.
Is breakfast included?
Yeah, yeah.
And I had breakfast with you this morning. So if you were having breakfast, what would you have?
Well, back in the home country, uh-huh, United Kingdom with Great Britain and Northern Ireland and Crown Territories is what it says on the passport. there are no hash browns.
Yeah.
In a full English. I just want to make that clear. It'd be the full English.
No.
Never, ever any hash browns on my plate. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, Gary, thanks a lot, man. I appreciate it. And thank you for your time.
Yeah, I'll see you on stage.
Yeah.
Right on. Gary Oldno. Told you it was going to be a lot of fun. Gary's a great guy. If you want to follow him on Instagram, you can find Gary at Deep Visual. I'm not going to promise you and tell you that he's going to follow you back, but you should go follow him. While you're online, check out Tone Shop Guitars. Use the code BREAKFAST15, receive 15% off your first online order, and you're going to get a free shirt on top of that. If they don't send you your free shirt, let me know and I'll call the owner myself. Hello? Also, check out isbreakfast.com. Check out our YouTube page. Like, subscribe, comment. Check out our Instagram. Follow, comment. And of course, man, order a shirt. Order something. We're going to be throwing a lot more products on there for you real soon. Well, maybe not a lot. Maybe a couple. Anyway. I'm sorry. I am done. Have a great day. We'll talk to you next week. That wasn't a week talk.